On this day of the month, we set the show aside, the 10 o'clock show aside, to talk about money management, personal finance. We've been doing that for a long time now, and generally with the same guest. His name is Dave Sinno. He is a clinical professor of finance at U of I in the College of Business, and he comes here and comes prepared to talk a little bit about sometimes the economy, sometimes a particular investment topic, and then we open up the phone lines and say whatever questions you have, either about whatever it is that we talk about at the beginning or anything else that has to do with financial planning, money management, investing. I know that Dave would do his best to give you an answer. So he's here this morning. Also, we have a special guest he's brought along with him, John Masevich, and maybe you remember John was here once before on the program. He's now doing a little guest stint teaching here at the U of I, teaching a course on personal financial planning. Between the two of them, I'm sure that they'll be able to answer a lot of questions. That's what we have up here in this first hour of the show. So without further ado, we'll say good morning to both of you, Dave and John, and thanks very much for being there.
Well, good morning, David, and as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. And as, of course, you mentioned, we have a good friend of mine here and colleague, Professor John Masevich. And John, of course, is a professor of finance at UC San Diego and a professional money manager to boot. And most interesting, every January, John leaves the warm confines of San Diego, California to spend 2 months in Champaign-Urbana teaching undergraduate students at the U of I courses in comprehensive financial planning and investment planning. This semester, he has undergraduates in both the College of Business and the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. And as I mentioned, John is a professional money manager with clients literally all over the country, as well as clients abroad, and the name of John's firm is Kensington Financial. And I thought it'd be instructive, since John is in town, for our listeners to visit not only with myself but with John as well, really on some perspectives of interest rates, perhaps the stock market, the bond markets, any questions that our listeners have. So, John, good morning.
Good morning, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
And let's jump in, John, and talk a little bit about what you think is the direction of interest rates and how you have your portfolios managed presently, at least in the bond side of things. I presume that you not only, of course, invest in the stock market, but you have bonds and bond indexes as well. And let me just have your feeling about interest rates in general, where things are going, and where you've got people positioned at the moment.
Right. Very good question. So I have a sort of a little preamble here. First, let's do maybe a review of 2003. The bond market last year was pretty decent. I think the average bond had a total return of about 4 to 5%. Whether you were in an individual bond or a bond mutual fund, you made 4, 5, 6%. And indeed, over the last 5 or 10 years, we've had a terrific bull market in bonds. We've seen annual returns in the range of 8 to 10% per year.
That's impressive.
Historically, this has been just absolutely terrific. But I believe, and this is just an opinion now, but it's an opinion shared by the people, many bond gurus that I respect, that the bond bull market is over, that we certainly cannot look forward to 8 to 10% per year in bonds. And it may even be a stretch to earn 5% this year in bonds. And I could go into that, if you like, with a more detailed argument.
Why is that? Why is that?
Well, I think there's some storm clouds on the horizon. And the first one, and I call this maybe just the common sense factor, interest rates right now are near a 45-year low. The last time rates were this low, let's see, I think Eisenhower was president.
Oh, golly.
You know,
I was born, though, John, so I was around in those days. I remember the start of the interstate highways, as a matter of fact.
Right. The benchmark in the bond market is the 10-year Treasury note. This is easy to determine. The Champaign paper has it. The Wall Street Journal has it. The 10-year Treasury note. Right now, the note is at 4%. Again, near a 45-year low. The low was actually about 3.6%, and I think that happened March of last year at about 3.6%. So one would think, just you know, just using common sense, if we're at a 45-year low, that the likely direction of rates is up, not down.
Okay, and when rates go up, the value of bonds vary inversely, so the actual value of a bond would drop.
That's right, and also a bond mutual fund. You know, so I don't care what kind of bond or bond mutual fund you have. Bonds are bonds, and if rates go up, your bond price will fall, which of course is not good.
Now, on the other hand, if you have a CD, a certificate of deposit, and you're just simply holding that to maturity, and you have a 4% yield, which would be difficult to procure in today's market anyway, then you obviously
cash it in
and you're looking at par.
Yeah, you cash it in today and you go to the bank to reinvest, and you're looking at bank money funds at about 0.5%. You're looking at CDs 6 months to 1 year out, of around 1 to 1.5%.
Those are the California rates? That's pretty much mirrors what's happening in Illinois.
Yeah, I believe so. Okay. There's a second problem in the bond market. This is not really, I put problem in quotation marks. The economy is now expanding at a very rapid rate. Granted, it is a jobless recovery, as we've all read, but the way we measure the economy is the gross domestic product, and we've been seeing increases of 5 to 6% on an annualized basis in the GDP. And historically, this is very high. The GDP normally grows at about 3%, and now we're growing at 5 or 6%. A rapidly growing economy could mean higher interest rates. At least historically, that's what's happened. A third problem is that, as I'm sure all of our listeners know, that we're running a huge budget deficit in Washington on the order of $400 billion. And it's not getting better, it's getting worse. I'm going to try to keep my remarks apolitical, but facts are facts. We have about a $400 billion deficit, and it's getting worse.
So that means that government has to borrow more money, so there's less money in the private sector, which pushes interest rates
up. Yeah, it's called the crowding out effect, that the government borrowing crowds out personal borrowing and corporate borrowing. And it doesn't mean that rates are going to jump all of a sudden. That is rarely the case. But over the next 1 or 2 years, the trend is likely to be up because of the huge budget deficit. And it's only going to get worse. I read a fascinating article in Business Week. It's the January 19th article. Laura Tyson is the columnist, and she's the former President Clinton chief economic advisor. And I grant you that she is on the left politically, but I can tell you that even well-respected economists on the right politically agree with Laura Tyson. And here's what she says. She says large budget deficits over 5% of GDP, excluding the Social Security and Medicare trust funds, are projected every year right up to when the first baby boomers start to retire, end quote.
That's me. I'm in trouble.
Yeah. And George Will, a conservative columnist writing for the Washington Post recently, said that we have a demographic time bomb working right now against us. In 4 years, in 2008, the baby boomers, that's us, start to retire en masse. We're going to start drawing our Social Security. Between 2008 and 2020, there's just going to be tens of millions of us retiring. What this means is that the Social Security Trust Fund is going to swing from a huge surplus to a huge deficit. Mm-hmm. So we got the fiscal deficit in Washington going on to the tune of $400 to $500 billion. And then when the trust fund runs out of money, in effect, that's going to swing to a deficit. So this doesn't look good to me.
Okay, so it sounds like that portends inflation and higher interest rates. John, yeah. I'm going to jump in because I think probably David wants to jump in with phone calls.
Yeah, in fact, we have somebody here who is calling in, and they're on a cell phone, so we'll get right to them. We don't want to make them wait any longer. We'll see what question they have on line number one right here. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have two questions, actually. The first concerns personal finances, taxes specifically. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the difference, the advantages and disadvantages of filing married joint versus filing married separate, and specifically what happens to mortgage interest deductions. Is that split in half, or are you not able to itemize if you file married separate, or if you could talk a little bit about that. And then my second question has to do with what you were just talking about, and if you could provide any kind of insight into how it is that we went from surpluses 3 years ago and talking about what are we going to do with surpluses to the deficit that you were just talking about. I'd appreciate any insight. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, John, I'll let you tackle the second question. And I'll be honest with you with the first question. I'm a little bit hesitant to talk about the differences between filing jointly and filing singly while you are married. I think those are really issues that you have to figure it both ways. You know, one of the things that you can do for about $25 or $30 is you can go to the bookstore and buy a very inexpensive software package, something as simple as TurboTax. It's a menu-driven program, and you can just literally list all of your income, all of your expenses, and they will take you through that menu both ways, and you can look at the impact. But to be very, very frank about it, you are probably best served by going to a tax professional. Clearly, there are different rates, and there are different issues with respect to itemizing, etc., but I'm not really an expert in that area, so what I would suggest is either, one, going and getting yourself a simple software package so you can enter those numbers, and two, then really going to a professional. With respect to direction of interest rates and direction of surpluses, obviously one major impact when we were talking surpluses, we were talking a much stronger economy. We were talking pre-tech bubble, really. We were talking about an expanding economy where we were having just this technology sector continuing to explode, the telecommunications sector continuing to explode, and everyone, both Republicans and Democrats, were looking at, what, almost a $2 trillion surplus. How are we going to spend that? And then a funny thing happened 3.5 to 4 years ago is all of that popped, and the economy didn't generate nearly the gross domestic product that we thought it would.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll add to that I think that both political parties are at fault here. Taxes went down. We've had 3 tax cuts under President Bush. But also on the spending side, spending has just gone crazy. Both the Democrats and Republicans have become some of the biggest spenders in the history of our country in the last 3 years on an annualized basis. And then you throw in the fact that we had a recession. We had the September 11th terrorist attack, which only exacerbated the recession. So I would say it's the recession, it's 9/11, it's the tax cuts. And I would say if I had to pinpoint anything, I would say the problem is on the spending side in Congress. And that's why we've gone from a projected $2 or $3 trillion surplus over the next 10 years to a projected deficit of $2 or $3 trillion over the next 10 years.
You know, the Wall Street Journal had a very interesting article yesterday that talked about how we fund this tremendous deficit and the engine of the U.S. economy and to continue its expansion. And very, very frankly, it's being funded on the backs of foreign governments and foreign corporations, which are really making money. Basically due to balance of payments deficits, they're taking more, they're essentially exporting more to us than we're importing, and as a result, net dollars end up with them. And what do they do with these net dollars? Well, they turn right around and they reinvest them in the United States, perhaps in equities, perhaps in real estate, but more often in the treasury market. And it's estimated right now almost $2 trillion of our treasury debt is being held by foreign corporations, foreign nationals, foreign individuals. And at the same time, because our deficit is expanding, our currency risk is increasing for these folks. In other words, our currency is worth a heck of a lot less today than it was 3 to 6 months ago vis-a-vis foreign currencies, for example, the euro. So when these people now have a U.S. Treasury earning interest on that U.S. Treasury, it matures, they get their money back denominated in U.S. dollars, and they want to convert them back to their currency, they maybe have lost 10, 15, 20%, and there's a real issue now of whether or not these particular holders of U.S. Treasuries are going to continue to buy U.S. Treasuries unless they become more worthwhile to own. And it seems to me, again, to make them more worthwhile, you better be paying more interest on those treasuries. And I think that's going to have an impact on the direction of interest rates in America, perhaps more than anything, if we don't get this balance of payments and the deficit a little bit more under control.
Yeah, David, I totally agree. And that was going to be the fourth factor I was going to bring up in presenting my case for higher interest rates. The trade deficit is also out of control. In that same article you read in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, there was a marvelous chart, and it had the percentage that foreigners own of our national debt. It's now 36%. They own 36% of all of our treasury bills, notes, and bonds and other government paper. If you look at this chart 30 years ago, they owned less than 10%. So, in other words, it's a big factor is what foreigners choose to do with their treasury bonds. If they choose to sell because they have lost confidence in the dollar, and as you said, the dollar is down about 20-25% just in 1 year. If they lose confidence and they start to sell, rates go up. Bond prices go down, interest rates go up. And I'll tell you maybe just a short story. My wife and I were in Paris about 2 years ago, and you know, we went out to eat, of course, and what we noticed at the time was that Paris was too cheap, which sounds weird. But the reason it was too cheap from our perspective as Americans was that the dollar was awfully strong. You could buy a euro for about 82, 85 cents, which is what the euro bottomed at about 82 cents. It came out at $1.17 4 years ago, and then it plummeted to about 82 cents. So we're eating in these Paris restaurants, and it's about $25 a person for wine, tax, and tip, and we're saying, hey, something's wrong here. We'd be paying more in San Diego or in Champaign-Urbana. And sure enough, 2 years later, the euro has now appreciated from about 85 cents to this morning, $1.25. So in other words, the
50%.
Dollar
has, yeah. It's almost a 50% increase.
That's right, from its low. And over the past year, the dollar has gone down about 20-25%. So certainly over the past year, foreigners have lost some confidence in holding our currency.
John, are you telling me that when my daughter goes and studies abroad, and she's already told me that I have to go and visit her and take on this whole European thing, that not only is it going to cost more money to just send her over there, that it's going to cost me more money to just go out and eat and have maybe a cheeseburger if they have such a thing over there?
Well, yeah, you'd probably be hard-pressed to find a cheeseburger
I know,
in Paris.
I know. But, I'm making a joke.
But, yeah, you're in serious trouble on the dollar front.
All right. Thanks, John.
We have another caller here I want to get in. And also for people who have maybe just tuned in, I better introduce our guest. So one of the voices should be from familiar to you. It's Dave Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. And once a month, he's here on this program. It's always a Friday. We talk about personal finance and money management. And this time, he also brought along a friend of his, John Misevich, who's in the investment counseling business in California. His home is in San Diego. He is an instructor at University of California there at San Diego. He's also, though, at the moment, an adjunct professor of finance at the U of I. He's doing a little guest appearance here. He's teaching a course on personal financial planning for graduating seniors. So I think he'd be in a good position to answer basic questions that people might have about money management and investing. In fact, that's really, you know, what we try to do on these shows, take a very nuts and bolts approach. We have frequently people calling and saying, look, here's my situation. What do I do? And then the guests will give you their best advice. So that's what we're up to here this morning, just like always on these shows. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a couple callers here. Someone in Champaign, next, line one. Hello.
Thank you. Given the dangers and concerns that you're talking about, I'm wondering how that should affect planning for investments for retirement, and you know, what kind of balance there should be in a portfolio, and possible also exposure to foreign markets, things like that.
Well, let me give you my thinking, because that's exactly where John and I were going, and that was really the next question that I was going to address is, all right, given all of these circumstances, where in the world should we be in terms of our portfolio, whether it's for retirement, whether it's for long-term investing? I've said, number one, the biggest mistake people make when they retire is to switch immediately into fixed income. I think that's a mistake. I think based upon life expectancies, especially for people who are married, that someone may well live into their 90s. So typically people who are retiring may be looking at a 25 or 30 year time horizon, which tells me that over long, long periods of time, you still must have significant exposure to equities, 50, 60% or more. On the other hand, if we are going to have a fixed income position, and John, I'll let you talk a little bit more about this. My feeling is that if you believe that the direction of interest rates is invariably up, then at least it makes good sense not to be in long-term fixed income at the moment, because that's the most volatile type of fixed income, that I would prefer people being in short and intermediate term, and really more to the short side than even the intermediate term.
Yes, David, I agree with that. I made one major move last year for my money and my clients' money. We went from intermediate-term bonds and long-term bonds into very short-term bonds. And by that I mean bonds, either treasuries or corporate bonds or Ginnie Mae's, maturing in 1, 2, or 3 years. I think it's just too risky to be out longer than that, because if David and I are right about rising interest rates, your bonds that are 4 to 5 to 10 years in maturity or longer are going to go down in value. But if you stick to, let's say, a short-term bond fund, and we could get into specifics if you want, if you stick to a short-term bond fund that has a portfolio with bonds maturing in 2 to 3 years, you could actually benefit from rising interest rates. My favorite fund, I guess we can mention specific funds, can't we?
Sure.
My favorite fund is Vanguard Short-Term Corporate Fund. Vanguard Short-Term Corporate. And what they invest in is high-grade corporate bonds maturing in a little over 2 years. What this means is that every year about half the portfolio turns over. The bonds mature, and then the bonds get reinvested. And if interest rates go up, half the portfolio will be reinvested at a higher rate. So over a 2 to 3 period, you could actually make money in the face of rising interest rates. Right now, the fund yields about 3%. And there are many other good funds out there. Fidelity has a number of them. But I would definitely stick to either individual bonds, high quality, maturing in 2 to 3 years, or very high-quality short-term bond mutual funds. But going back to your original question, what are the retirement planning implications? I'm a strong believer in having a balanced portfolio. And traditionally, that means about a 60-40 split between stocks and bonds, 60% stocks, 40% bonds. But I think there's an argument that if stock appreciation is going to be lower in the future, and I think it will be because of the problems we've been talking about, and if bond returns are going to be lower, I personally believe that maybe a 50-50 split is in order, a more conservative asset allocation split than the traditional 60-40. So your retirement plan, whether it's your retirement money, whether it's your 401k, your Roth IRA, your IRA, or non-retirement money, I think you have to look at your entire portfolio, determine what that asset allocation is with a spreadsheet or just on a yellow pad of paper, and go from there. And I think if you're in that balanced position, you're going to be fine no matter what happens.
Well, I'm looking out about 15 years, and also I'd like you to address the question about exposure to foreign markets.
Yeah, I think you should have some exposure. And research at Vanguard itself, I'm a big fan of the Vanguard. By the way, I don't get any commissions or kickbacks from Vanguard. I just want to make that clear. I happen to have half my money there and almost all of my client money there. But it's a fine group. And internal research at Vanguard indicates that there's a good argument for having roughly 10% of your portfolio in foreign securities. But here you want to have a well-diversified international stock fund. Vanguard has several, Fidelity. I mean, all the big mutual fund groups have them. I think there's a good argument to have 5 or 10, maybe 10%. And so if the dollar keeps falling, and I think it actually will, I don't think the dollar is going to collapse, but I do think it's going to continue to drop this year. What this means is that the euro will appreciate. And so if you have a foreign stock mutual fund and the euro goes up, all other factors being equal, you will make money just because of the currency factor. And then if the stocks in the portfolio go up, well, then you'll have a double whammy in your favor. You'll have the stocks going up. You'll have the euro going up. And so I think you can make a decent return, especially over the long run. My advice would be, have some semblance of a balanced portfolio, and maybe 5 to 10% of that ought to be in the foreign securities markets.
And let me just jump in. If we're going to be in foreign securities, and John, I'm actually even a little heavier in foreign securities, I think in terms of an asset allocation model, rather than just being in the largest of the large, which is sort of like being an S&P 500 of the world, and then you're really talking about currency risk, that a lot of academic and historical studies have shown that if you're going to be an international investor, that the real returns are in some of the smaller areas. For example, even the Pacific Rim, the emerging markets, et cetera. So if you were going to, for example, put 10 or 15% of a dollar into foreign markets, I would be more heavily weighted, probably two-thirds, one-third, in the smaller areas, the emerging markets areas, the Pacific Rim, maybe even as opposed to the European index, or what is commonly referred to as the EAFE index. I've always thought of that as just an S&P 500, and then you're involved in currency risk. So in terms of an asset allocation, you're looking at, for your situation, maybe 50-50 or 60-40, and maybe 10 cents of that dollar into the foreign markets. Would that be fair?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm probably more oriented toward the European markets. Personally, I don't have the stomach for the Pacific Rim. I got burned in 97 when the Asian markets collapsed, and I've been smarting ever since from that, but you could be right.
Okay, I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, let's continue here. Next person up would be in the Chicago area on our toll-free line. Line 4, right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question, I'm of retirement age, and I have a fairly well balanced portfolio, but my question has to do primarily with the fixed income part. I have a fair amount of funds in Ginnie Mae's, actually through Vanguard, and I don't know if I'm looking at this correctly. The point is, I'm not as concerned with the value of the bond going up and down because it's not something I'm going to particularly sell in the near future, I'm more concerned with the yield. And so rather than have it in, you know, other instruments that would yield less, I've kept a fair amount in the Ginnie Mae. Does that make sense?
Yes. I totally agree with you. By the way, I have my mother in that fund, the Vanguard Ginnie Mae Fund. It's a wonderful fund. And I have a lot of my retired clients in the same fund. The yield right now, as you probably know, is about 4.5%.
Right.
And that's actually pretty high, believe it or not, even though, you know, a year or two ago it was 6 or 7%. But, you know, that's we have a new world today, and it's 4.5% or so. That's actually quite good.
Uh-huh.
If you looked at short-term treasuries, you'd be looking at 2-point-something.
Uh-huh.
If you looked at high-grade corporate bonds, you'd be short-term, you'd be looking at 3-point-something, maybe
uh-huh.
maybe 4% at the most. I've got some Daimler Chrysler bonds, and I think they're about 4-point-something, but they're intermediate term. Yeah, but so Ginnie Mae's, especially the Vanguard Fund, at 4.5% is excellent. And that fund is particularly good in that they have a very low management fee that they charge you every year, called the expense ratio.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's only about 0.2%. It really doesn't get any better than the Vanguard Ginnie Mae Fund. And if you're not concerned about fluctuation in the price, I would just hold in there.
Well, thank you. That of course, confirms what I've been feeling, so
right.
That's helpful, what I've been thinking. Thanks a lot. This
All right.
Very interesting.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to over to Indiana for somebody else on the line, too. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have $10,000, which I would like to use in terms of investing in a very, very general sense within the next 6 months. That goes all the way from going to Gary to gamble or do something else. It's sort of money I do not have to worry about. What would you do?
Well, is this long-term money? In other words,
I'd
are
like
you
for
worried?
It to, I'd either want it to mature or pull it within 9 to 10 years.
Well, you know, that's a tough one. That's a very tough one.
I've been waiting for this to occur again on the radio is because I've asked other people, and most of the time I get, shall I be nice and set a sales thing to do it one way or the other.
Yeah.
My phone's starting to go, so I'm going to let it go, and I'll listen to you on the radio.
Okay,
right.
Very
Thanks
good. It's an excellent, excellent question. One of the problems is you've got a 10-year time horizon. And a 10-year time horizon, there are certainly no guarantees, not that there are any guarantees in investing, but there are certainly no guarantees that an equity position would increase in value over any 10 consecutive year period of time. If you want to be a legacy investor, a long-term investor, you really need to be looking at 20 to 25 year time horizons, because then you have a pretty strong probability, if you will, that your portfolio will certainly increase and may even well outperform inflation. So with a 10-year time horizon, however, I think we still can talk about asset allocation if you are truly willing to tie your money up for 10 years. And if I had a client who came in and said, Dave, I've got some money to invest. I want to invest it for 10 years. I probably would be looking at a 70%, 30% asset allocation. That is 30% equities and 70% fixed income. John, I don't know how you would feel about that allocation. But in terms of the 30% in equities, I would be extraordinarily well diversified. I would have money in U.S. large, U.S. small, U.S. large value, U.S. small value. I would probably be in an REIT. And then I would have a small percentage in international. So I would probably have 30% of my money spread among 6 or 7 different index positions. And then with my 70%, well, I'd be in fixed income. And at the moment, I would be in short fixed income. I probably wouldn't even be in a Ginnie Mae fund. I would probably be shorter. I would probably be in a short-term corporate bond fund, or I might even very well ladder short-term bonds or short-term treasuries. I don't know how you feel about that, John.
Well, I think I'll have a disagreement with you here. I would probably reverse it. You're 30-70 equities to fixed income.
30 equities, 70 fixed.
Right. With the 10-year time horizon, I think 10 years is a sufficiently long time to make a decent rate of return. I agree with David. You know, there's no guarantees from year to year, but, you know, 10 years covers a lot of potential scenarios. For example, if you look back over the last 10 years, a lot has happened in the last 10 years. We had a couple of recessions. We had 9/11. We had the most horrible bear market since the 1930s. From 2000 through 2002 inclusive, stocks lost 49% as measured by the S&P 500. As measured by NASDAQ, stocks lost 75%. All that being said, if you look back over 10 years, guess what the average annual return has been? 10% per year, right at the historical norm. So going forward, I would say that, despite all the problems we've outlined today about rising interest rates and all that, I think things will probably get worked out over 10 years. And I'd probably reverse the asset allocation. I'd probably go 70-30 or maybe 80-20, with 70-80 being in stocks. I'd pick a couple of Vanguard funds, no load, low expense ratio. There's one real aggressive fund that Vanguard has. It's a great performer. I have most of my clients in it called the Vanguard Prime Cap Fund. And you could counterbalance that with maybe the Vanguard S&P 500 fund, the index fund. And then for the other 20 or 30%, you might even look at a junk bond fund. And Vanguard's got a particularly good one called Vanguard High Yield. High quality junk. It sounds like an oxymoron, high quality junk, but there really is such a thing. These are double B rated bonds like Safeway Supermarkets and CBS and so forth. That's what I would do over 10 years. I really think that's a sufficiently long period of time. But the premise underlying this recommendation is that you're not going to be timing the market. You're not going to be going in and out. You're just going to invest the money for 10 years or so and hope for the best. And I think there's a good chance you'll make 8 or 9% per year.
I think one of the issues is with $10,000, how well diversified you really can become.
Mm-hmm.
For example, using Vanguard funds, if you could do this, for example, inside a Roth IRA or an IRA program at Vanguard where you can purchase a fund for $1,000, otherwise, when you're looking at asset allocations, you're typically involved in spending at least $3,000 on the equity side, at least at Vanguard,
yes,
to own a fund. So with $10,000, you're a bit limited. So as a result, that's why I've skewed a little bit of the mm-hmm. asset allocation. So maybe I jump up a little bit, and maybe you're 70-30, I'm 30-70, maybe 50-50 is a reasonable compromise.
Well, with Vanguard, the minimum investment, as you say, is $3,000 per fund. You could have three funds. You could have two stock funds and one bond mm-hmm. fund for $9,000, $10,000.
Maybe the total market index, for example.
Yeah, that's right.
Would be an example that you could mm-hmm. use, and even you could perhaps even use on the international side, total international.
Right. But I think the main thing is not to jump in and out of the market with the $10,000. This is sort of your mad money. You know, presumably you can afford to lose it. If you can't afford to lose it, don't do it. but I think 10 years is a long time. I think, I'm reasonably optimistic over 10 years.
Okay.
All right. Let's go on here. Next caller up would be caller in Bethany, and it's line number 3. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. Enjoying your program.
Good.
I would like for you guys, because I think you guys are really good to listen to, I would like for you to talk a little bit about market valuations right now. I kind of congratulate myself that I had the foresight to start getting out of stock funds in 98 and 99. But now I'm almost all in money markets and the short-term bond, and to me, a P.E. ratio on the S&P 500 just seems awfully expensive for me to try to go back into stocks.
I think it's, what, at 24.5?
Maybe 28.
Is it that high?
According to the Wall Street. If you look at the S&P 500.
All right.
If you guys just want to talk about that a little bit, I'll just hang up and listen to you.
All right. Well, thanks.
Well, John, you can jump in there, but mm-hmm. obviously stocks are not cheap.
No.
In terms of historical parameters, for example, P.E. ratios. The S&P 500 mm-hmm. at 28 is yeah. certainly not cheap, not inexpensive. In fact, it's much closer to its historical highs.
That's right. Stocks are very expensive. Warren Buffett recently opined, the man himself, Warren Buffett, he says he can't find any bargains anywhere. So he's kind of hunkering down in all kinds of other, alternative investments. But the caller is right. If you look at today's Wall Street Journal, the P.E. ratio on the S&P 500 is 28 to 1. This is not cheap because the historical norm is 15 to 1. So we're almost double the historical norm. That being said, I think there is a bullish case to be made long term in that you can't just look at the historical norm. I mean, this includes the 1930s, the 40s, the 50s. I mean, that's ancient history. We are more productive now. We've got the internet. We've got, all kinds of, high-tech equipment that has made everyone more productive. So an argument is being made that maybe a normalized PE, taking into consideration the higher productivity that we're now operating at, and also taking into consideration the fact that we have lower interest rates today than we had 10 years ago, which is a big, big factor in stock valuation. Taking those two factors into consideration, an argument is to be made that a normalized PE is somewhere in the low 20s. Okay? So that is above the historical norm of, say, 15 or 16 to 1. But I would argue it should be above the historical norm because, again, we are more productive and interest rates are lower. So I would say that stock prices are on the high side, but not all that high. You know, maybe 28 versus a normalized 23 or 24 on the PE side. So there's some danger, but I don't think it's outrageously overvalued, in my opinion.
No, and that may be a good reason to go into value stocks,
mm-hmm.
for example. If you are considering averaging into the market or looking and taking capital into the market, one of the most appropriate areas might be the value sectors. In other words, the small cap value sectors and the large cap value sectors, because if you look at those particular types of stocks based upon PE ratios as well as book to market, you'll find that those may be the areas which are going to explode and do better on average than the higher PE stocks.
That's right. That's really the way to play it safe today. Tilt your stock portfolio to the value side rather than the growth side. All the big mutual fund groups have value funds. Go to Morningstar.com, do a search of all the big mutual fund groups. You'll come up with many good value funds. That is really the safe way to play this market. Also, I mentioned Warren Buffett before. He's the classic value investor, and that's where he's always stayed. He has never bought growth stocks. He's always eschewed the high-tech stocks.
That's right. He never bought a high-tech stock.
No, and he was right. He made money during the bear market, one of the few.
We are moving here into about our last 15 minutes, and I want to introduce our guest again, Dave DeSino. He's a clinical professor of finance at U of I College of Business, and once a month on a Friday, he's on this program, and we do this show about money management and investing, and he's here to answer your questions. You have some concerns about your own particular situation, you can call and lay it out, and he'll give you his best advice. And also, we have a special guest this time around, John Masevich. He is an adjunct professor of finance here at U of I, teaching a course on personal financial planning. He's also an instructor at University of California, San Diego, where he lives and has a financial planning business out there. Questions are certainly welcome. I know that both Dave and John will do their best to give you an answer. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up is a caller in Champaign. Excuse me. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if I could get your opinion. I have a 15-year mortgage with about 9 years left, and I was considering refinancing to a 30 and then invest the difference of my mortgage payment to offset some deficiencies in my portfolio. What do you think of that strategy?
Tell me, first of all, what interest rate you currently have on your 15-year mortgage?
5 3/8.
That's a tough one. That's a tough one. Are you itemizing on your tax return?
Yes.
Yeah, I think if you're itemizing on your tax return and you're getting benefit from the interest deduction and you're already 6 years into this mortgage, I just don't think it makes a lot of sense from my perspective. John, I don't know how you feel about it because you're going to have to earn essentially more than 5 3/8 and you're already getting a tax break. That's going to be tough. That's going to be tough safely and cleanly.
I totally agree. 5 3/8 is an excellent rate. I would leave it alone, and it's probably the lowest rate you'll ever pay for the rest of your life.
Okay.
I just think it's dangerous to mortgage your house to go into stocks or bonds or real estate or anything. You've got a great rate. You'll be out of this completely in 9 years. You'll be home free. I would leave it alone.
Okay. Yeah.
And the beauty of it is that really once you get past the first 5 years in a 15-year mortgage, you really start to hammer down against that principle. Really, really quickly.
Yeah. Let me make one final point, too. As you're paying down this 5 3/8 loan, you're actually, in effect, making an investment earning 5 3/8%.
Absolutely.
And if you look at the fixed income market today, it is hard to get 5 3/8%. I was talking to the caller before. She's in the Vanguard Ginnie Mae fund. Well, she's getting 4.5. You're getting almost a point more than that, in effect, by paying down this loan. It's awfully hard to get 5 3/8% unless you go out in, maybe buy 10-year bonds, which we definitely don't recommend. So I think, in effect, you have a good investment by paying down a 5 3/8 loan. If you eliminate a 5 3/8 cost, it's really the flip side of the same coin. The other side of the coin is you're making a 5 3/8% return on your money, which is pretty good.
And on top of that, really, since you are itemizing, if indeed you are getting the benefit of that itemization, your effective rate is really more like 4%.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really cheap money today to borrow 4%. It's very, very tough to do. So I think you're best served by retaining that mortgage, continuing to make those payments. And it won't be very long before that mortgage will be retired.
Yeah, I would congratulate yourself on having such a wonderfully cheap loan.
Okay, thanks.
Very good. We'll go over to Champaign County next, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I have a real investment question, and it resonates around this community. There's a lot of adulation of the CSRS investment. I'd like for you to explain if that's warranted and if it's not just a bump up from what had been rather bad performance in the past. I haven't actually read the News Gazette article on it, but so I'm asking you to dissect it. I think often things go behind, but I do have to rise to the occasion when you surveyed the deficit and the reason you didn't even mention tax increases, decreases, tax cuts.
No, actually,
we did. We did.
Well,
we did. We mentioned.
I heard the emphasis on the spending, so.
Both.
Okay. Well,
in any event, let me talk about CSRS. I think CSRS is one of the most well-run programs in the country, bar none. They historically have earned rates of return that have put them in the top tier of pension funds across the country. And one of the reasons is because many, many years ago, they really went to pretty much of an indexing strategy. And that is, as far as I understand it now, somewhere between 70 and 80% of those funds are indexed to the markets. And they are long, long-term investors, and they have just done extraordinarily well. I have nothing but accolades to say about the administrators at CSRS as well as the investment performance of the CSRS program. I can tell you, having been at the University of Illinois for a number of years, my money is in CSRS. I've opted to stay in CSRS. I think it's an extraordinarily well-run program. And I congratulate CSRS for staying the course and taking those excess funds and not buying short-term treasuries, but keeping to their goal, their objective, their legacy of being long-term investors, and it really has paid off over the last 6 to 12 months.
So it is authentic, huh?
Absolutely.
But it wasn't that long ago that it didn't, right after the bubble broke, but to everybody, I guess.
Well, relative to everybody, CSRS has outperformed almost year in and year out relative to everybody, and certainly relative to the average investor.
Well, I didn't hear your emphasis on the tax thing. With the O'Neill conversation with Cheney, deficits don't matter. It's really, that's more actually having more shockwaves maybe than the other part of the expose. But I also just heard some analysis about what's really going on with authentic valuation, and is the market really working? And despite the fact that there are some things going on about Exxon and stuff, I've heard people say that the most egregious forms of misrepresenting one's assets and values and hiding things are maybe gone somewhat, but there's still a lot of misrepresentation. So the P are the earning, it distorts the market, and it's still widespread. So you're arguing that there should be a different analysis for the PE ratio, but if we're still not getting authentic information.
Well, that's a pretty big presumption that now we're not getting authentic information.
Well, we haven't been. It's very clear that we haven't been, and there are people that are, who have credentials in this area. You can hear them on talk shows, other talk shows that are saying that they're still not investigating enough, and there's still a lot of misrepresentation. And the market is supposed to have good information, but if it's garbage in, it's garbage out.
Well, comments?
My only comments are that I think that we've moved dramatically away from that, and that, frankly, most information that is now procured is pretty decent information. CEOs now who have to sign off on financial statements can go to jail if they are providing us with false information knowingly and even unknowingly, as a matter of fact. So I think things have tightened up. Accounting firms are much tighter in terms of their audits. There have been relationships that have been severed between the accounting arm, the audit arm, and the consulting arm of major certified public accounting firms. I think things are a lot better. I think it's a lot easier to believe data today than perhaps 24, 36 months ago. And the bottom line is that most companies have been scrupulously honest. That is the bottom line. Of the thousands and thousands and thousands of publicly traded companies, on balance, most of them have provided honest, intelligent information.
I would agree, David. I think the caller does bring up a good point, though. He's really alluding to pro forma accounting. And there was a lot of abuse in this in the 1990s, but with a lot of recent legislation passed, I think things have become more transparent. there are all these arcane issues. Do you expense options? Do you not expense them? Warren Buffett, for example, thinks we should expense all options that are given to executives. And this could have a dramatic difference in earnings. I've read, for example, if Intel expenses options versus not expensing options, it made a tremendous difference in their reported earnings. But I think there's more transparency about this now. And, you know, with the legislation, I tend to agree with you.
We have now less than 10 minutes. We have a number of callers. We'll just keep going here, trying to get in as many people as we can. The next in line is a caller in Urbana and line number 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
What might I do with $3,000 to start a savings program for a grandchild?
Well, that's a laudable goal, number one. How old is the grandchild?
3.
3. Wonderful. Well, you might consider an educational savings plan. That is a new program that really has become very, very popular over the last 3 years, in which typically parents and grandparents put aside money for grandchildren. This money can be placed in one of two types of programs, either in, for example, in Illinois, a prepaid tuition program, or, for example, actually in some type of long-term investment program. And the beauty of these educational savings programs are that all of the earnings grow tax-free so long as when the child takes them out, spends them for higher educational purposes.
Now, this child's in Indiana. Can I invest in an Illinois program?
You can invest in any program in the country. And, in fact, mutual fund companies team up with various states to even offer these programs. And, again, not to toot the horn of Vanguard, that's a particularly good educational savings program. You can go to the website, read about it, and then you can access the Vanguard funds. I think it's an excellent, excellent idea. And these particular programs allow you to have the child use all of this money for higher educational expenses. And that includes tuition, fees, room, board, anything, books affiliated with higher educational expenses. Just a tremendous, tremendous program, especially beneficial when you are having younger children, 3, 4, 5, 6
right.
years
old. Is there a minimum to start the program?
I think most are $1,000 to $3,000, and interestingly enough, for wealthy people, what they can do is they can bunch up their gifts. In other words, you or I typically can gift $11,000 to as many people as we want. So let's say that we have one grandchild, and we could actually gift that grandchild $11,000 and put it away for that grandchild in some type of savings program, investment program, and that is free of gift tax and free of income tax. But interestingly enough, under these particular programs, an individual can gift up to 5 years at once, which is 5 times 11, or $55,000. Can you imagine taking $55,000, putting it into one of these educational savings programs, and basically then investing it for that grandchild, letting it grow, and then that grandchild probably could use all of that for undergrad, graduate school, you name it. It's a wonderful, wonderful program. That would be, so the vehicle becomes important to choose, and that would probably be one of the new educational savings programs. It's called a Section 459 plan.
Say that again.
Section 459 plan, under IRS Section 459.
Okay.
Yeah, there's another plan, too, the 529 plan.
Or 529. Yeah, I'm sorry. 529. Section 529, not
right.
459.
I would also direct you, go to, there's a great website. It's called savingforcollege.com, all one word, savingforcollege.com. It was started by a Professor Hurley, and he surveys all of the 50 states' plans. You could pick any one. If you like the Utah plan, you could pick that one. You could pick the Connecticut plan. And Vanguard is an advisor for several of those state plans.
Now, the child can use the money in any state, then?
No. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But here's something to bear in mind. The money that you put into this plan, you're making a gift, an irrevocable gift into this plan, and it must be used for college.
Okay.
Unlike a custodial account, which doesn't necessarily have to be used for college expenses, but these 529 plans must be used for college.
And what happens if the child doesn't go to college?
Well, if the child doesn't go to college and the account gets cashed in, then the earnings essentially in that account are subject to tax.
I see.
But here's one more thing you can do. If the child does not go to college, you can switch it to another beneficiary.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so there's tremendous flexibility in these 529 plans.
Okay.
So again, savingforcollege.com, it's a wonderful educational website.
Okay.
Having looked at that particular website, John, and looking at all the plans, to be honest about it, I like the Iowa plan, the Missouri plan, and the Nevada plan the best. Those are my three favorites.
I also like the California plan, and I'm not just saying that because I'm from California, but...
Oh, you are.
No, no. But, no, really, the California plan uses as their advisor the TIAA CREF group. This is, I think, the largest retirement group in the world, and they manage money for college professors, a TIAA CREF, and they have a wonderful track record. I think they're in the league with Vanguard.
No question about it. As a matter of fact, the University of Illinois, through their 403B program, one of their advisors is TIAA CREF.
We're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have a number of callers we can't take, but we've just, even though we have a little more time here than usual, we just burned up the time taking a lot of questions. So we want to say thanks very much to John Masevich, for being here. He's an investment advisor, has a firm out in San Diego, and right at the moment is spending some time as adjunct professor of finance, teaching a course on personal financial planning. And, of course, Dave Sinnoh, he's a clinical professor of finance at College of Business, and he is here every month. Always on a Friday we do these shows. So thank you both very much.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Dave, always fun. Lots of great questions.
And also remember the program that we have on Saturday mornings here, a program called Sound Money. It's another opportunity to get some information on investing and ask questions. Of course, we want you to think very carefully about where you put your money. Think about it. Research it. Get a lot of advice before you make your decisions.